The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
So this man's account of what he says he saw is critical because it certainly creates that circumstantial evidence that something happened in the home, in the Patterson home. Someone possibly was killed there, at least one person, and then they disappeared.
Margaret and William Patterson were last reported seen on March 5, 1957. The telegram, sent on March 15, 10 days after the Pattersons were last seen and received by the Pattersons' accountant, Herbert Roth, ordered that their home be rented out for at least 9 months, and D.G. Prince, owner of a local janitorial company, was employed to get the house ready to be leased. Attorney David J. Smith said the telegram was no fake, as it contained things only he and William were privy to. William, according to Smith, had said that he wanted to incorporate his business with himself as head, and subsequently retire to Mexico for at least 3 years, though William had done little to see that transition through. Longtime friends of the Pattersons, who lived in Jackson, Michigan, but whose names are unknown, were expecting to see the couple at a photography convention in Washington, D.C. at an unspecified time in March, the month the couple vanished, but they never showed up, called, or canceled. He said that this was not like them at all. He'd personally made the reservations for the Pattersons at the Statler Hotel. Of course, the telegram from March 15th gave instructions specifically to Art Moreno, William Patterson's apprentice and right-hand man at Patterson Photo Supply, to cancel the reservations in D.C. On April 1, 1957, the Patterson's close friend and owner of the Ward Motor Clinic, Cecil Ward, called Patterson's Photo Supply to ask what he should do with the Patterson's Cadillac, as it was repaired and had been there for weeks. A Patterson Photo Supply Shop employee later came and picked up the vehicle. The next several months saw nothing but quiet speculation by those in the community as to the truth behind the Pattersons' whereabouts. When friends or patrons of the Pattersons inquired as to where the couple was, employees insisted that they were on vacation in Florida or at a photo convention in Washington, D.C. Their departure was abrupt. But since the police weren't involved, and the couple often traveled, overt concern was virtually non-existent. Neighbors continued to feed Tommy, the Patterson's adored feline, who was seemingly left to fend for himself. Longtime friends, Mr. and Mrs. Ray Thompson of Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, were owners of the Thompson Boat Company. They'd sold William the boat he'd been working on with Cecil's help. Mr. Thompson noted that William still owed him for the boat, and that the Pattersons were also expected to have attended a boat show with he and Mrs. Thompson on May 1st. When they didn't show up, Thompson called Patterson Photo Supply several times and was finally told by employee Art Moreno that the Pattersons were on an extended vacation. Duffy Sasser, associate of William Patterson and owner of Duffy's Photo Service, allowed employees to buy stock in his company. Kirkland, an associate of William's who managed the newly opened Duffy's Photo Service in El Paso, had taken full advantage. He owned 10-12% of the business and was beginning negotiations with a partner to buy the entirety of Duffy's. Kirkland oversaw Patterson Photo Supply for about a month, then returned to his home in Lubbock, where he became president of Duffy's Photo Service there. He'd make trips to Patterson Photo every few weeks, checking on the business end, but after July never returned. During this time, Kirkland suggested that Roth work some for Duffy's. Roth did, and ended up buying 8 to 9 shares of the company. In July of 1957, a British couple, Lieutenant Colonel Philip Belson, his wife, and their children, moved into the Patterson home. Their move-out date was scheduled as December 15th of that year, or 9 months from when the telegram was received that gave instructions to rent out the house. Lieutenant Colonel Belson brought a stray cat to the DLKD Animal Hospital on September 3rd because the animal had bitten one of his children. The Belsons had been feeding the cat off and on. The cat was instantly recognized by Dr. Cady as Tommy, and upon inspecting the feline and realizing his condition, was sure something was amiss. Tommy would usually be kenneled and well taken care of when the Pattersons left town, and the pet's malnourishment and abandonment raised a red flag. Margaret would not, under any circumstance, leave her precious Tommy to fend for himself. Tommy stayed at the animal hospital. After the reemergence of the Patterson's cat, word around town began to spread that there was more to the couple's absence than what had been simply explained as an extended vacation. A few weeks prior, and 5 months after the Pattersons were last seen, on August 15, 1957, Cecil Ward filed a missing persons report with the El Paso County Sheriff's Office. Sheriff Jimmy Hicks assigned the tight-lipped deputy sheriff, John B. Frizzle, to attempt to locate William and Margaret. Frizzle said it was the most baffling case he'd come across in his 17-year career. Investigators learned that D.G. Prince, who had cleaned the Patterson's residence after the telegram came in, found the house in utter disarray, with unwashed dishes in the sink and underwear and a pair of stockings laid out on the bed, as if they were to be worn soon or put away. El Paso County Sheriff's Office investigators were clueless as to what happened to the Patterson's Cadillac at this point. Sheriff's Office investigators began collecting information that might lead them to Margaret and William's whereabouts, none of which suggested that the couple had gone on holiday. The Patterson's trailer home had been sold. William and Margaret hadn't withdrawn any unusual amounts of money before their disappearance, and absolutely none after. Some of the Patterson's expensive items of clothing, including a fur coat, were left at the cleaners, and no instructions as to storage had been given. Utilities at the Patterson residence had not been disconnected. The newspaper and mail were still scheduled for delivery. Virtually every possession the couple owned had been left behind. Attorney David Smith told the El Paso Herald-Post that even if he did know where the Pattersons were, he wouldn't tell the newspaper or Sheriff Hicks under the client confidentiality agreement. The attorney did, however, say he'd been making extensive efforts to locate them. Investigators were able to determine that the telegram was called into Western Union from Dallas Love Field Airport and was paid for in nickels, dimes, and quarters through the payphone used to make the call. They were unable to confirm that it was indeed William who'd phoned it in. El Paso County Sheriff's officers searched the couple's basement for recently poured concrete and scoured their backyard for freshly covered holes. The Patterson home sat just below a large desert hill, and presumably, this area would have been included in the search for recently disturbed earth. They found nothing. It was as if the Pattersons had simply ceased to exist. Margaret's signature, which used to adorn all company checks, was replaced by Herbert Roth's, the Pattersons' accountant and business manager. Both Roth and Kirkland were reluctant to speak with Deputy Sheriff Frizzle or the press, and when questioned, Roth's go-to response was always, "No comment." Early into the investigation, police discovered that William Patterson kept a mistress, Estefana Arroyo Marfan, a described 20-year-old party girl, lived in Juarez, Mexico, and worked at a nightclub there. Estefana was enchanted by William's doting and charm, and he with her youthful beauty. The deputy sheriff claimed that the young woman received a letter from William in April of 1957. Apparently, Estefana stormed into the El Paso sheriff's office, denying that she had, and was given a lie detector test, which she passed. Later, investigators stumbled upon what would end up as a lead to another mistress. They found what was described as a notice of auto sale in William's paperwork. The notice led them to another woman William had been seeing in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He'd bought the woman a Ford Thunderbird. She told investigators that the Ford was repayment to her for financing William's Cadillac, a story the detectives didn't buy. When she came clean about the affair, she told investigators that she'd given William the ultimatum to leave Margaret, to which he replied, "I could never leave Margaret." Though William often borrowed money from his friends to keep Margaret from finding out about his expenditures, she was aware of his extramarital activities and sought consolation at the bottom of a bottle. William's family was located and informed of the situation. They were concerned, of course, and requested a formal inquest and told police that if Margaret and William did not return or at least disclose their location, they would continue to push for one. However, after speaking with Roth and Moreno, they decided not to move forward. They were reassured that they had left on an extended vacation and that Tommy was being cared for by neighbors. Margaret Patterson's relatives, maiden name, and even where she was from, were still mysteries to everyone until after April 1958. The badly decomposed body of a woman thought to have been dead approximately 1 year was found in California. The description fit that of Margaret Patterson. The El Paso Times circulated a photo of Margaret to other papers across the U.S. Her former landlords in Evansville, Indiana, recognized her and were able to give information that led to her siblings, who hadn't seen her in over 20 years. One of Margaret's sisters told the press, "We thought she was dead." The body was not Margaret's. In June of that year, the Patterson's attorney, David Smith, received a typewritten letter dated May 29th of that year and signed by hand. The letter read,
"Dear Dave, I want you to handle this matter for us. We will not be back to El Paso, and by the time you get this, we will be out of the country and nobody can find us. We want Art, Doyle, and Herb to each have 1/4 of the business. The other 1/4 must be divided equal among the other employees at the store. See that Art gets the house and furniture. Doyle is to get the cabin, tools, boats, and the Cadillac. Keep the VW for the business as well as the lots. I expect you to be fairly paid for all the trouble. Margaret wants her account to go to the CYO. Art Moreno, Doyle Riley, and Herb Roth should make a good trio to run the store from now on. Yours truly, W.D. Patterson."
Since the details on the letter are specific, and there is actual knowledge of assets and the photo supplies personnel, it was written by someone familiar with the Patterson's interests. Neither the envelope nor the letter provided a return address. Handwriting experts were unable to determine with accuracy if the signature matched William Patterson's penmanship when compared. Investigators for the El Paso County Sheriff's Office found it odd, though, that no assets were allocated to any of William's many living relatives. The letter, along with what investigators found or perhaps didn't find, prompted members of William's family and Margaret's family to request a court of inquiry. Kirkland testified that he received a call from a person claiming to be William at 3 a.m. on March the 6th, 1957, and that the caller told him that he and Margaret were leaving for a long vacation. Kirkland, half asleep, he claimed, asserted that the man, who he says he assumed was William, wanted him to have use of his prized Cadillac while they were away. He said he was almost certain that the voice was indeed William Patterson's. At the time, Kirkland was a resident of El Paso. He told the court that on March 4, 1957, he, Cecil Ward, and William all gathered in the Patterson's garage to work on William's boat, which they'd all planned to do the next night as well. Cecil became ill, though, so the plans for the 5th were canceled, and Kirkland did not visit the Patterson home that night, he stated. Kirkland took over the store after the Pattersons went away, for a salary of $800 a month, the equivalent of $7,100 today, as was instructed by William via the telegram received March 15, 1957. Luther Patterson, William's father, told the court, "I always knew William and Margaret would take off like this someday. They're not dead. My boy has done things like this before." He said that William had the free-spirited heart of a Kearney. "Pat will come back when he's ready," he added. Numerous sightings of the couple were called in. Some reported seeing them in Mexico, some in the U.S., but officials at the El Paso County Sheriff's Office were unable to confirm a single one. At an unknown point in the investigation, a woman who lived in the Upper Valley told police she heard a woman scream, followed by the sound of a car's tire screeching on the night of William and Margaret's disappearance. Patterson Photo Supply continued to prosper, grossing nearly $1 million at one time. The business was sold in 1962. Margaret and William Patterson were declared legally dead in 1964 by Judge Richard E. Crawford after last-ditch attempts to recover information as to their whereabouts failed. Assets, including cash, U.S. Treasury notes, life insurance, a lot of land, and their home, worth more than $75,000, were divided amongst William and Margaret's surviving relatives. Luther Patterson, after failing to hear from his son for several years, said he now suspected that the couple was dead. Tommy eventually died while still being boarded at the D.L. Cady Animal Hospital. It is said that he died of a broken heart. Even after many years, when the case was long cold, additional information as to what happened to the Pattersons materialized sporadically. A woman who'd been a neighbor of Margaret and William told the press in 2013 that she'd been at the couple's home to deliver Girl Scout cookies, which they'd bought from her daughter, and that Margaret seemed very upset. She'd gotten the strong impression that William was upset that she was in the house and wished her to leave quickly. The woman also said, though, that William always came across as mean and unfriendly, which seems in dire contrast to what friends and some neighbors have reported about the man over the years. There was, and is, no shortage of theories as to what happened to Margaret and William Patterson. Police originally thought the Pattersons to be victims of a kidnapping, but since no ransom was ever made, the theory fizzled out. Many El Paso residents, and some beyond the city's borders, speculate that Margaret and William were the victims of an alien abduction. Several other theories took form and evolved as different investigators took on the case, and even more as El Paso locals spread the mysterious tale. As the Cold War raged, espionage became one such theory. This explanation was deemed valid by at least one investigating officer. In 2009, El Paso County Sheriff Leo Samaniego, the El Paso Times would later inquire to the FBI whether or not the two were ever suspected of being Red spies.
They were contacted about whether they had any information on if the Pattersons had been involved in espionage. And at the time they said they didn't have any such information. Because one of the suspicions was that the couple was involved in spying. And this is because Mr. Patterson was seen often taking pictures of military and forklifts, an important military installation here. back then, we're talking about the Cold War era. So that's how that suspicion developed. I was a part of law enforcement, sheriff's office. But again, there was no proof of that. That doesn't mean that didn't happen. But it's a blind lead.
Others speculate that Margaret killed William due to his extramarital indiscretions in the heat of an argument. The Pattersons' marriage was described by some who knew them as volatile near the time of their disappearance. Margaret's drinking had escalated, presumably caused by William's affairs, and the two were reported to regularly argue and bicker at one another. Shortly before they vanished, Margaret found a picture of a young Estefana in a pocket of a jacket belonging to William. It was reported that the couple had an extremely heated argument over this event. Did Margaret, by intent or by accident, kill William in the throes of an intense fight? The scenario is possible, but not without its own set of problems.
Of course, there's one of the theories out there that if she had accidentally killed a husband, then there would really been no reason for the associates to then create this elaborate cover-up. There wouldn't have been the need to do that. But nevertheless, that's what happened. I mean, and it, you could say, okay, he died, but what about her? There would be no benefit to them.
Some believe that William and Margaret were killed and buried somewhere on their property, many insisting that the couple still haunts their home on Piedmont to this very day. While it does seem likely that the Pattersons would have been found if they were, in fact, put in some sort of shallow grave within their home's perimeter, assuming the police did a thorough job in their search there, the theory that Margaret and William were killed there is plausible. Neighbors witnessed what they described as flashlights moving around the backyard of the Patterson home the night of March 5, 1957. Though revelatory and crucial to considering foul play by associates, that is hardly the most critical witness statement given. In 1984, a man named Renaldo Nangare came forward with information that turned the entire investigation on its head. His account is, for all intents and purposes, shocking and could easily be the most vital information that the police have ever received about the Pattersons' case.
From the information he gave to the police, he saw blood around the water heater in the garage and a piece of human scalp on the propeller of the Pattersons' boat. The Pattersons used to park their boat in particular inside that garage. He also found a pair of jeans with a Rolex watch that belonged to Mr. Patterson, and that he also saw one of Patterson's associates remove bloody sheets from the home and put them inside the trunk of a car. Now, he obviously identified the associate to the police. Now, police did not reveal who Mr. Nungarai identified as having removed the bloody sheet, but that would be in a police report that is not releasable because police continue to carry it as an open investigation. It sounds like maybe somebody was pushed and fell or somehow ended up falling against that propeller on the head.
The capacity in which Nangare worked for Kirkland should be considered, as should the risk he would have taken coming forward in 1957 and his later connection to Art Moreno.
Well, I think that he had no reason to make up this story. He had no reason to lie about it. I finally was able to get a hold of Art Moreno to ask him about Mr. Nungarai's allegations. He dismissed them all. Like I said, Mr. Nungarai called the police, told Detective Pedro Bonilla that he did not come forward sooner with his story because he was an undocumented immigrant at the time. He feared that he would be deported. And he was probably right. But, you know, I think that we can only speculate about what police would have done with Mr. Nungarai if he had spoken back then in the early stages of the investigation. You know, it would just be speculation.
Well, when that whole thing with the Pattersons happened, he had just been there for just a few months. So, you know, I'm sure, assuming that, it might have just been some kind of starter position, but I do know he had moved up the ladder over the years. But I think he worked for him for probably guessing about 10 years or something. because they changed names. It was Duffy's at the time, and then later it was Fox Processing. My dad and Art were actually pretty good friends, and they're actually business partners for a few years. And my dad actually owned a processing lab. He actually owned a couple of studios at some point, but one of the ones that I took over, actually. But Art and my dad were partners for a while.
There's something also interesting on the Nungaray angle. Mr. Moreno, Art Moreno, and Nungaray had developed a business association, film development, and that kept them in close contact with each other off and on over the years. But Nungaray felt that this close association was created to keep an eye on Mr. Nungaray, which, you know, could be interesting. If anybody thought he knew something or could get someone in trouble, then he would be one to keep an eye on, you know, keep him close to you sort of thing. But I think that's not far-fetched. Well, eventually he did get into film development, but he did a job, you know, whatever was needed. Started out that way. You know.
Or perhaps William killed Margaret and fled. Though an argument could be made that William's associates would have had more to risk than gain by helping him cover up the death and disappear, Patterson's photo supply was an immensely lucrative business, and any promise William might have made to give the company to an individual or individuals who would help him may have enticed them to do so. An argument in the garage, resulting in Margaret falling or being pushed, her head landing on the boat's propeller, doesn't sound out of the realm of possibility. Estefana told investigators from the El Paso County Sheriff's Office that William had come to visit her in the early morning of March 6, 1957, and told her something important was about to happen. She said he told her, "When they come for me, I'll have to go in a hurry." Estefana later recanted that statement. A company that claims its purpose was to find missing people came forward to the El Paso Herald-Post and told the newspaper that William was in a sanatorium in Dallas at Margaret's urging. It is unknown exactly when William was supposed to have been checked into the facility. Roth, upon receiving the news, hastily flew to Dallas, but the hospital told him William had never been there. This seems like a dead end at first sight. But, along with a telegram of March 15th being sent from Dallas, there is another possible connection to the city. Florence Wagner, who lives in a Dallas suburb, is William's niece. Though she can't remember the exact date, Wagner says that as she waited at a crosswalk at Harwood and Commerce, sometime in March 1957, a light-colored, new model car stopped at the light just beside her. She said that the man driving the vehicle was William Patterson, her uncle. As soon as she noticed him, the light turned green, and the car sped away. Information about the disappearance of William and Margaret Patterson, please contact the El Paso County Sheriff's Department at 915-538-2292. Next time on Gone Cold Podcast, the 2010 disappearance of Alexandria Lowitzer. If you would like to support the show, you can do so by subscribing, leaving us a review on iTunes, sharing the cases with a friend, or stopping by our Patreon page and making a small donation. You can subscribe to Gone Cold Podcast on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, Auto Radio, Stitcher, Google Play, or your favorite podcast app. We can be contacted on Facebook or Twitter by using @GoneColdPodcast. We have a closed Facebook discussion group where we exchange ideas about the cases and post pictures so please join in. We would like to thank Richard O. Jones from the incredible True Crime Historian podcast, who contributed his time and distinctly wonderful voice to this episode, and Ray Nungarai Jr. for sharing his stories about his father with us. We'd also like to thank Diane Washington Valdez, author, journalist, and president of the DigiZone Network in El Paso, Texas. Mrs. Washington Valdez published The Killing Fields, Harvest of Women, an investigative book that exposed the Mexican killing fields, which claimed the lives of hundreds of women at the Juarez-Mexico border. Her story has inspired a documentary film, as well as a Hollywood movie. I purchased my copy at Amazon last week and have almost finished reading. It's hard to put down. I'm in awe of Miss Washington Valdez's work. I strongly recommend you guys check it out. If true crime is your thing, please check out thetruecrimefiles.com. There you can read about many cases. It's always well presented, and the insight always fantastic. Thetruecrimefiles.com never disappoints. Please stay tuned for a promo from the Moms and Murder podcast. If you're looking for a lighthearted approach to true crime, look no further. They do an amazing job. Thanks for listening, y'all.
Hey guys, this is Mandy and Melissa from Moms and Murder, a true crime podcast featuring two moms who think they're funny.
Trust us, guys, we are. Join us each week as we discuss both the infamous and unfamiliar stories in the world of true crime.
You can check us out on our website at momsandmurder.com and also connect with us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.
We release new episodes on Tuesdays, so we hope you'll check us out.
I took the blues and packed my shoes and left the Lone Star State. I thought if I should ride away, I would lose the blues. But I found out that Texas soil was sticking to my shoes. I'm heading back. I've got the Texas blues. My mouth, some bitter ups and hollers. Hey, are you from the south? They laugh at all my high you alls each time that I speak. And what's more, this foreign soil keep burning both my feet. I'm heading back. I've got the Texas blues. Buildings way up high, they built that way to swing and sway and dust out all the sky. They got me out of Texas so I could really see, but they play the Dickens getting Texas out of me. I'm heading back. I've got the Texas blues.